north wind behind them, the Turks once again bore down upon their adversaries. As they fought, the wind rose to gale force. The sea grew increasingly rough until close maneuvering became impossible. The Venetians fought desperately to get to windward, but gradually they were forced down the narrow channel to the harbor. In such weather, entry into ports was impossible. The vessels could only lie in the roadstead, but there they were raked again and again by the pursuing Turks. It was a disaster. The Venetian losses were immense, the Turkish comparatively slight. The captain general called a council of war, but the outcome seems to have been a foregone conclusion. There were no longer enough men available for the adequate manning of the fortress. The defenses were in lamentable condition. The treasury was empty and supplies were running low. Long before any help could be expected, the Turks were bound to attack again, and when they did, the consequences would be catastrophic. So it was that the island of Chios was won and, within less than 6 months, was lost again. On the night of 20 February, all the war material that could be carried away was loaded onto the ships, the remaining defenses dismantled or destroyed. Then, on the morning of the 21st, the fleet sailed out of the harbor. With it, to escape the vengeance of the Turks, went most of the leading Catholic families of the island, who were granted new estates in the Peloponnese to compensate them for what they had left behind. Even on her departure, Venice's ill fortune went with her. Scarcely was the last ship round the mole when one of Zinn's most important remaining vessels, the Abbondanza Ricchezza, laden with arms and ammunition, struck a hidden rock. All endeavors to free her failed, and she had to be abandoned with most of her cargo still intact on board. To the people of Venice, who had so recently been celebrating the recovery of Chios, the news of its loss was a matter of less sorrow than for anger. The Senate demanded an immediate inquiry, pending which the miserable Zinn, together with several other senior officers, was brought back to Venice in chains. He died in prison in July 1697 while the inquiry was still in progress. Its findings were never made known. The Turks were not beaten, but they were undeniably battered, and seemed likely to welcome the opportunity for a negotiated peace. The Emperor Leopold, for his part, was anxious that they should do so, for he knew that a fresh crisis was approaching. Not on his eastern border this time, but in the west, where the half-mad and childless king, Charles II of Spain, obviously had not long to live. There were two principal contenders for his throne, Leopold himself and Louis XIV of France, both grandsons of Philip III and sons-in-law of Philip IV, and Leopold, understandably, wished to have his hands free to deal with the struggle ahead. England and Holland, horrified at the prospect of seeing France and Spain united under Louis, offered their mediation with the Sultan. Poland and Venice, on the assumption that they would retain the territories they had conquered, were only too pleased to lay down their arms after 15 years of war. The arrangements were quickly made, and on 13 November 1698, the various powers concerned met at Karlowitz in Hungary, now the Serbian town of Sremski Karlovci. The negotiations did not run as smoothly as had been expected, the representatives of the Sultan pointing out that their master, not having surrendered, saw no reason why he should be required to abandon all the territories now in Christian hands. In particular, he had in mind certain of his Mediterranean possessions. Venice could have the Peloponnese. He would make no difficulty about that. She could also retain Lucas on one side and Aegina on the other, and a number of fortresses on the Dalmatian coast. He himself, however, was determined to keep Athens, Attica, and all Greek territory north of the Gulf of Corinth. The Venetian representative objected violently, but received little support. The emperor, once he had been assured of Hungary and Transylvania, was anxious to get home as quickly as possible. He let it be known to the Venetians that, if they insisted on making difficulties, he would have no hesitation in concluding a separate peace, For a time, the Republic continued to argue, and when the treaty was signed on 26 January 1699, she was not among the signatories. But at last, wisdom triumphed over pride, and on 7 February, the Doge finally appended his seal. It was as well that he did so, for the Treaty of Carlowitz is the one diplomatic instrument above all others that marks the decline of Ottoman power, and Venice, which had directly confronted that power for longer than any other Christian state, had more right than any to be party to it. On the other hand, her forced renunciation of an important part of her conquests was not just a blow to her self-respect, it made it considerably more difficult for her adequately to defend that part which remained. There was now nothing to prevent the Turks from invading the Peloponnese from Attica, or indeed from anywhere along the north shore of the Gulf of Corinth, a point which they were all too soon to prove. Chapter 19. The Wars of Succession. On Friday, 1 November 1700, King Charles II of Spain died in his palace in Madrid. Weak in body as in mind, he had come to the throne at the age of 4, on the death of his father, Philip IV, and one glance at the luckless child had been enough to convince the court of his total inadequacy for the task that lay ahead of him. Charles looked like a caricature of a Habsburg, his chin and jaw projecting so far that the lower teeth could make no contact with the upper ones. He was always ill, to the point where many suspected witchcraft. Few of his subjects believed for an instant that he would grow up to assume power over his immense dominions. But grow up he did, and, after a 10-year regency under his mother, Mariana, daughter of the Emperor Ferdinand III, he took over, at least in theory, the reins of government. Thus, from the day of his accession in 1665, and for the next 35 years, Spain was effectively a great monarchy without a monarch. Never was there a suggestion that Charles might have a personal policy of his own. He was hardly ever at his desk, except when there were papers, almost always unread, for him to sign, and the day in May 1694, when he was obliged to miss his lunch, caused such astonishment that it was recorded in a contemporary journal. Government of the country was left to a succession of prime ministers of varying ability and to the grandees of Spain. And above all, to the church and its principal instrument, the Inquisition. As the king himself told the British ambassador, he never meddled in religious affairs. Jews and Protestants were the Inquisition's most usual victims, but in fact no foreigner was safe. When the ambassador's chaplain died in 1691, he had to be buried in secret. Even then, his body was subsequently dug up and mutilated. And there is no doubt that the expulsion of the Moriscos in 1610, achieved by the Inquisition acting with the dreadful Duke of Lerma, had dealt Spain a blow from which it took centuries to recover. On the Moriscos had depended much of the agricultural production of the country. Cereals, sugar, rice, cotton, even paper. What little industry Spain could boast had also been in their hands. Thus, by 1700, Seville and Toledo, Segovia and Burgos, were pale shadows of what they had been 100 years before. For the peasantry and the working-class populations of the towns, conditions grew bleaker with every year that passed. In 1699 came famine. A crowd of 20,000 assembled before the royal palace, and a full-scale revolution was narrowly averted. It came as no surprise that Charles II, despite 2 marriages, had failed to produce any offspring, and as the century drew to its close, the question of who should succeed him grew steadily in importance. The problem was that the Spanish crown was coveted and indeed claimed by the 2 mightiest dynasties of Europe. Of the 2 daughters of King Philip III, the elder, Anne, had been married to Louis XIII of France, the younger, Maria, to the Emperor Ferdinand III of Austria. Anne had in due course given birth to the future Louis XIV, Maria to the Emperor Leopold I. Louis might have been thought to have a secondary claim through his wife, Maria Theresa, who was Charles II's elder sister. Unfortunately for him, however, his bride had been obliged on her marriage formally to renounce all hereditary rights in the Spanish dominions. Charles's younger sister, Margaret, on the other hand, had made no such renunciation, and when she had married the Emperor Leopold I, her small grandson, Joseph Ferdinand, son of her daughter Maria Antonia and Max Emanuel, Elector of Bavaria, was consequently the Habsburg claimant. Already the scene seemed to be set for a struggle. When, in 1698, Charles made a will confirming Joseph Ferdinand as his heir and successor, the matter might have been thought to be settled. But in February 1699, the young prince unexpectedly died. His sudden death was attributed, rather unconvincingly, to smallpox. There were many, among them the boy's own father, who suspected poison and did not hesitate to say so. Once again, intricate diplomatic negotiations began, not only among the three powers most directly concerned, but also with the participation of England and Holland. These two maritime countries both carried on immensely profitable trade with Spain. There were several British and Dutch merchants permanently resident in Cadiz and other Spanish ports. Through much of the 17th century, the two had been at loggerheads. Now, however, they shared a common concern: to keep out the French. If Spain were to pass from the hands of the weakest monarch in Europe into those of the strongest, what chance was there that trade would be allowed to continue? Backwards and forwards shuttled the ambassadors between the European capitals until, in June 1699, what was known as the Second Treaty of Partition, never mind the first, was signed by William III of England and Louis XIV of France. It was hoped that the States General of Holland and the Emperor Leopold would give their assent later. By its terms, the formerly Spanish kingdoms of Naples and Sicily were allotted to France, together with the Spanish lands along the coast of Tuscany, and, in exchange for Milan, the Duchy of Lorraine. Spain and the rest of Charles II's inheritance would fall to the emperor's younger son, the Archduke Charles. In March 1700, the States General signed up. Only Leopold held out. He saw no reason why France should help herself to any imperial territories, and he was particularly incensed at the idea that he should surrender Milan. So far as he was concerned, his son should assume the entire Spanish inheritance, and he was prepared to fight for it. Leopold's reactions were moderate, however, in comparison to those of the Spanish court, when in June the terms of the treaty were communicated to Madrid. It was reported that on receipt of the news, the king flew into an extraordinary passion, and the queen, in her rage, smashed to pieces everything in her room. Clearly, Spain's greatest hope of support lay with Austria, a natural ally against the partitioning powers. Letters flew between king and emperor, and the prospect of war began to loom larger still. But Charles had one more surprise up his sleeve. By the autumn of 1700, it was plain that he had not long to live, and on 3 October, he put his tremulous signature to a new will, by the terms of which he left all his dominions without exception to Louis XIV's 17-year-old grandson, Philip, Duke of Anjou. A month later, he was dead. What caused this sudden change of heart in favor of France? Above all, the Church. The Inquisition, and indeed the whole hierarchy and clergy of Spain, had long favored a French solution, and Pope Innocent XII, who was actually to die 5 weeks before the king, had himself written to him recommending the Duke of Anjou. With the consciousness of approaching death and the voice of his father confessor whispering into his ear, Charles no longer had the strength to argue. "Never," wrote King William of England on 16 November 1700, "did I much rely on engagements with France, but I must confess, I did not think they would have broken in the face of the whole world a solemn treaty before it was well accomplished." He cannot, in truth, have been all that surprised. Louis, or at least his grandson, had been offered on a plate far more than he could ever have hoped for, and the king's character was certainly not such as to pass it all up for the sake of a treaty upon which the ink was scarcely dry. Well aware that Leopold would not accept this new dispensation without protest, he lost no time in packing the young claimant off to Madrid to assume his throne without delay, in company of a bevy of French officials to take over all key posts of government, and as his special guide and mentor, the redoubtable Princesse des Arcens. In fact, Philip V was to be readily accepted in his new kingdom, only Catalonia proving hostile. But this was by no means enough to ensure an uncontested succession. What Louis could not have known was how long and how desperate the ensuing war would be, or what a price he would have to pay for his grandson's throne. The Treaty of Partition was now hardly worth the paper it was written on. Clearly, it would have to be replaced. And so on 7 September 1701 at The Hague, representatives of England, Holland, and the Empire signed what was to become known as the Grand Alliance. In certain areas, its terms were left deliberately vague, and its principal objectives for the coming war, the imminence of which could no longer be in doubt, were plain enough. The imperial aims were frankly political. Leopold was out to recover for the Empire all the Spanish possessions in Italy. Those of England and Holland, on the other hand, were almost exclusively commercial. They wished only to secure the future for their navigation and trade. But 7 months before, in February of that same year, Philip of Anjou had entered Madrid as Philip V of Spain, and French troops had occupied the Spanish Netherlands. The war had already begun. The War of the Spanish Succession is, for most of us, associated with the great Duke of Marlborough, and it was in Northern Europe, not in the South, that he created his magnificent legend. Those blood-soaked battlefields of Blenheim, Ramillies, Oudenarde, and Malplaquet are hundreds of miles from the Mediterranean and no business of ours. But the Middle Sea, too, played its part. Indeed, the war began with a brief land campaign on Italian soil, during which the French were able to secure various formerly Spanish possessions in Lombardy and the Po Valley. And at the very outbreak of hostilities in 1701, a considerable Allied army had assembled in the South Tyrol under the command of Prince Eugene of Savoy, with the objective of expelling them. Meanwhile, the French commander, the splendidly named Marshal Nicolas Catignat de la Faucagnerie, who had no intention of being expelled, and assumed that the prince would follow the valley of Adige, drew up his army on the shores of Lake Garda and awaited the attack. But Eugene was too clever for him, sending a small detachment along the right bank of the Adige as a feint. He brought the bulk of his army, 16,000 foot and some 6,000 horse, by narrow and obscure mountain paths over Monte Baldo, finally approaching the French unexpectedly on their right flank. Catinat lost his head. Taken completely off guard and uncertain of Eugene's intentions, he spread out his army in small detachments over some 60 miles. It was a fatal mistake, of which the prince took full advantage. Attacking one detachment after another, he scored a succession of small but decisive victories, culminating in a midwinter raid on Cremona to capture another marshal, the Duc de Villeroy, and threw the French into total confusion. The following year, they recovered. Catinat had been succeeded by the Duc de Vendôme, an infinitely better general whose army had received massive reinforcements sent by Philip of Spain from Naples. Eugene, his lines of communication with Vienna suddenly cut off, was thrown for the first time onto the defensive. By then, however, the epicenter of the war had shifted. Italy was largely forgotten. But not the Mediterranean. Already at the time of the Partition Treaty, the future of the Middle Sea had been much in King William's mind. It was not only the continuation of trade with Spain that preoccupied him, It was also the realization that, if Spain were to pass into Bourbon hands, England might be excluded from the entire Mediterranean basin unless she could find herself a secure stronghold within it. He had long had his eyes on Menorca, and he was also planning with his admiral, Sir George Rooke, to occupy Cadiz before the French could do so. William's death, in March of 1702, put paid to this latter idea. Rooke had never had much enthusiasm for it, and his attack on the port the following autumn proved a fiasco. 2 years later, however, he redeemed it in full, when, with an Anglo-Dutch fleet, he captured Gibraltar. The Rock had been in Spanish hands since 1462, and in 1501 had been formally annexed to Spain by Queen Isabella. But its defenses were poor, and its tiny garrison showed little appetite for resistance. It surrendered to Rooke on 4 August, having held out for just 3 days, at a cost to the attackers of 60 killed and some 200 wounded. The admiral had a real chance to show his mettle only 3 weeks afterwards, when, on 23 August, off the Spanish coast near Malaga, he ran into a French fleet of about 50 sail under the Count of Toulouse. What followed was later described by Rooke as the sharpest day's service I ever saw. Losses were high on both sides. There was no doubt, however, that the British had the best of it. When day broke on 27 August, there was not a Frenchman in sight. The French fleet had withdrawn to Toulon, and for the rest of the war made no effort to dispute the Allied control of the Mediterranean. The capture of Gibraltar had not immediately made it a British colony. Technically, Rooke had taken it on behalf of the imperialist claimant, the Archduke Charles, and almost exactly a year after its fall, on 2 August 1705, the Archduke had disembarked from a British naval vessel and had been formally recognized there as King Charles III of Spain. Meanwhile, the Rock was garrisoned by 2 British and 2 Dutch regiments, and although its governor, Major General Sir John Shrimpton, was an Englishman, he and his staff continued to acknowledge Charles's sovereignty. On the King's birthday in 1705, 3 rounds from 35 guns were fired in salute. On that of Queen Anne, 5 months later, there was only 1 round from 21 guns. But these were early days when Charles still seemed to have a fair chance of winning the Spanish throne. Later, as those chances diminished, the future of Gibraltar took on a different complexion. Surely there could be no question of its passing to the hated Philip V, and through him, for all anybody knew, to his still more hated grandfather, Louis XIV. How much safer if it were kept permanently in British hands. The first major Italian campaign opened only in 1706. Prince Eugene had recognized that further progress was impossible without substantial reinforcements, and had returned to Vienna to find them. Taking advantage of his absence, Vendôme had launched a surprise attack on the imperial army at its camp near Brescia, and had driven it back into the Tyrol. He had, however, reckoned without Eugene, who, with 24,000 troops from Germany, raised thanks to an English subsidy of £250,000, entered Italy early in July down the valley of the Adige, and marched south to the Po, crossing it, then headed west along the right bank, driving the enemy before him. At Via Stellona, just south of Pavia, he joined another army under the Duke of Savoy, and together they advanced on Turin, where, though easily outnumbered, they inflicted a resounding defeat on the French forces. It was the end. In March 1707, by the Convention of Milan, Louis XIV abandoned northern Italy. In Spain, on the other hand, he continued to fight. Indeed, he had no choice. In the spring of 1706, a squadron commanded by Admiral Sir Cloudesley Chauvel had carried a force under the Earl of Peterborough through the Straits of Gibraltar to the east coast, where Barcelona had willingly accepted the imperial claimant as King Charles III. Meanwhile, an English-Dutch-Portuguese army under the Earl of Galway had invaded Extremadura from Portugal and had continued eastward to Madrid. It entered the city on 26 June, only to evacuate it again after a few weeks in recognition of one indisputable fact, that outside Catalonia and Valencia, Spain was overwhelmingly in support of King Philip. Disappointment over Madrid was, however, easily outweighed by Allied succession in Northern Europe, to the point where, in August, King Louis made it known that he was ready to come to terms. He would leave Spain to Charles in return for the recognition of Philip's right to Milan, Naples, and Sicily. At that time, it need hardly be said, neither England nor the Empire were prepared to listen. 12 months later, they may well have wished that they had. The year 1707 saw no great victories in the north, and in the south, two disasters. The first was when, on 25 April, Galway's motley force of some 15,000 men was heavily defeated at Almansa, some 60 miles southwest of Valencia, by a greatly superior army of French and Spaniards under King Louis's leading general, the Duke of Berwick, the natural son of King James II of England, by the Duke of Marlborough's sister, Arabella. At a single blow, Valencia, Murcia, and Aragon were lost to the Allies. Worst still, perhaps, they were therefore unable to supplement the forces of Prince Eugene when, in July, he attacked Toulon. Eugene was almost as great a general as was his chief, the Duke of Marlborough. It is sad indeed that his last venture in the Mediterranean should, through no fault of his own, have cast something of a shadow over his reputation. If his attempt on Toulon proved a failure, this was due entirely to his two principal allies, the Emperor Leopold and the Duke of Savoy. Leopold had, at the critical moment, seen fit to detach some 13,000 men to attack Naples. Savoy, for his part, had shown himself to be weak and indecisive, so much so that by the time Eugene eventually landed on Provençal soil on 26 July, the battle was already as good as lost. 10,000 men were needlessly sacrificed. It was perhaps some consolation to know that, rather than allowing Toulon to fall into Allied hands, the French had deliberately scuttled their squadron of some 50 sail in its harbor. The fact remained that their principal southern port, which should have been Eugene's for the taking, had been forfeited through sheer inefficiency and muddle, and the English fleet was still deprived of the one thing it needed more than any other, a good, safe harbor in the Mediterranean, where it would be protected from winter storms, where its provisions and supplies could be safely stored, and where its ships could be properly refitted. As things turned out, it did not have to wait much longer. Menorca, the furthest of the Balearic Islands to the northeast and consequently the nearest to France, had long been an object of interest to the British Navy, and in the summer of 1708, Major General James Stanhope, who had been sent to Spain as minister, but who had some months before succeeded Galway as commander-in-chief, received orders from Marlborough to take the island's capital, Port Mahon. Supported by a fleet of 34 ships under Admiral Sir John Leake, who had hastened to Menorca from Sardinia, where he had been bombarding Cagliari, he landed in Menorca on 14 September with about 1,200 British, 800 Spanish, and 600 Portuguese troops. It was another fortnight before he was ready to attack. A road had to be constructed to carry the guns and provisions the mile from his landing place to his first objective, Fort St. Philip. Even then, the fort's commanding position overlooking the harbor made it almost impregnable. Stanhope dealt with the problem by offering generous terms for its surrender and threatening to slaughter the entire garrison if these were not accepted. The French and Spanish commanders might even have continued to resist had it not been for the large number of women and children who had taken refuge there. They therefore decided to surrender, a decision they were later to regret. Both were subsequently imprisoned and the Spanish commander killed himself. Other forts quickly followed St. Philip's example, the speed of Stanhope's progress being due largely to the goodwill of the local population, who had had quite enough of both French and Spaniards. The magistrates of Mahon willingly handed over the keys to the city as soon as the invaders approached. By the end of the month, the entire island was effectively in British hands. It was to remain so with a short intermission between 1756 and 1763 for very nearly a century. To Stanhope, it mattered little that the island, like Gibraltar, had technically surrendered to King Charles III of Spain, who was indeed formally proclaimed as its king on 8 November. England, he wrote, ought never to part with this island, which will give the law to the Mediterranean both in time of war and of peace. To emphasize the fact, he left a garrison consisting entirely of British troops, all the Spanish and Portuguese being returned to Spain to assist King Charles. By June 1709, he had spent £11,000 on the island's defenses. To Galway on the Spanish mainland, meanwhile, matters were looking increasingly grave. He tended to blame his reverses principally on his Portuguese troops. At Almansa, they had been a distinct liability, and early in 1708 marched them back to their homeland. They were replaced by Germans, made available by the recent armistice in Italy, under their commander, Count von Stahremberg. But even then it proved impossible to stop the imperialists taking Tortosa, so cutting communications between Barcelona and Valencia. Not until 1710 was any progress made, when the Allies marched for the second time on Madrid. The city fell on 23 September, but once again Charles failed to hold it. By the end of the year, he had to retreat to Catalonia. Even there, his hold was tenuous enough. In January 1711, the French captured Gerona. Then, just 3 months later, on 17 April, the Emperor Joseph I died in Vienna at the age of 33. This time it was unquestionably smallpox. And the entire European political scene was transformed overnight. Joseph had succeeded his father, Leopold, in 1705, had done much to reform the empire's chaotic finances, and had warmly espoused the claims of his younger brother, Charles, to Spain. But Charles was now not just a Spanish claimant. He was the obvious successor to his brother on the imperial throne. The Grand Alliance had been formed only in order to prevent a single family, the Bourbons, from becoming too powerful. If Charles were to succeed to the empire, as indeed he did, being elected in the following year, the Habsburgs threatened to be more powerful still, with all their dominions once more united as in the days of his great-great-great-great-uncle Charles V. Inevitably, many months were to pass before the European powers were able to come to terms with the new situation. It was not until New Year's Day, 1712, that negotiations began between the Allies and France in the Dutch city of Utrecht. Before we leave for Utrecht, however, we must return briefly to Minorca and to Gibraltar, whose status remained ambiguous. In England, the Whigs, who had dominated the first half of Queen Anne's reign, had been replaced by a Tory government, and the new ministry had decided that the Emperor, Charles VI, was now a far more serious danger than the Bourbons had ever been, and no longer merited British support. Besides, the Bourbons, too, were now ready for peace. The war in the north was threatening France with disaster. Marlborough was still carrying all before him, and King Louis was increasingly anxious to come to terms. Concessions would therefore have to be made, preferably, Louis being Louis, with other people's property. And what concessions could be more acceptable to the British than the acknowledgement of their claim to Gibraltar? On 31 May, the king informed Queen Anne, on est parole du roi d'Espagne, de laisser au anglais Gibraltar, pour la sûreté réelle, de la commerce en Espagne et dans la Méditerranée. In fact, he had nothing of the kind, but Philip was in no position to complain. Hitherto, he had been a good deal more fortunate than his grandfather. The war in Spain against Charles and his allies had been moderately successful, but for how long would his luck hold? The succession to Charles to the empire meant that the latter would henceforth have all its resources at its disposal. There were also rumors that Prince Eugene might be sent to take over the command in Spain, and Philip was all too well aware that he had no generals with half the prince's experience or brilliance to set against him. Finally, if France and Britain made a separate peace, he would be deprived of all French military support. He saw that he had no choice, and so he reluctantly informed King Louis that he was ready to offer the British both their recent conquests. Peace negotiations were quietly and discreetly set in train. Britain recognized Philip V as King of Spain, while Spain and France were obliged to accept that Menorca and Gibraltar would remain in British hands. At first, Louis kept quiet about Menorca. The rock was of little strategic value to him. The island, on the other hand, was only a day's sail from France and, as he had recently seen, could be used as a springboard for an attack on Toulon and his Mediterranean coast. So he had no intention of handing it over unless he had to. What he did not know was the admonition that had been given to the British negotiators before they left for Utrecht, that they were to insist that Gibraltar and Port Mahon, with the island of Menorca, be for the future annexed to the crown of these realms, and not to take no for an answer. There was still a little trouble with the Dutch. They had played their part in the taking of the rock in 1704, and they had provided an important part of its garrison ever since. They had, understandably, expected to be rewarded. Now, equally understandably, they felt betrayed. At first, they refused to withdraw their troops from Gibraltar, even threatening to continue the war alone. But no one took them too seriously. The truth was that they desperately needed British support to protect them in the Netherlands, and both they and the British knew it. What is generally known as the Treaty of Utrecht was in fact a whole series of treaties in which, after a European upheaval that had lasted for 11 years, France and Spain attempted once again to regulate their relations with their neighbors. Most of the subjects upon which agreements were reached do not concern us here. Where the future of the Mediterranean was concerned, however, both countries made major concessions. France and Spain both formally recognized Duke Victor Amadeus II of Savoy, who happened to be King Philip's father-in-law, as King of Sicily. His northern dominion extended to include the formerly French city of Nice. Spain, in addition, accepted the transfer to the empire of the formerly Spanish areas of Italy and the Netherlands, and effectively handed over Menorca and Gibraltar to Britain. She did not, however, do so unconditionally. Although the treaty conferred on the British crown perpetual property rights over part of the present territory of Gibraltar, Britain has shamelessly extended it since, provided that the Catholic religion should continue to be freely exercised and that Jews and Moors should be prohibited from settling there. The ultimate sovereignty over the rock she explicitly reserved to herself. What is rather less well known is that she also put her name to the so-called Asiento Agreement, by which she gave the British the exclusive right to supply her overseas colonies with African slaves at the rate of 4,800 slaves a year for 30 years. The Emperor Charles fought on until 1714, and the final peace had to be signed without him. It was essentially on his behalf that the great struggle had continued for the past 12 years, and by distancing himself from the peacemakers, he did his empire a lasting disservice. His interests were not altogether ignored during the long negotiations at Utrecht, but since they were fundamentally opposed to those of France, Bourbon, Spain, and the United Provinces, as the Dutch now call themselves, while Britain remained largely indifferent, it was inevitable that they should have been to some degree neglected. Nevertheless, when the negotiators returned to their homes, Charles found himself master not only of the body of his empire, but also of the Catholic Netherlands, Milan, Naples, and Sardinia. He was hardly in a position to complain, but with a modicum of diplomatic finesse, he could probably have done better still. And the Spanish throne? This was, of course, the most important question of all, the original casus belli, the reason for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of men across the continent. It was at last resolved, as it by now virtually had to be, in favor of Philip. His kingdom had been drastically amputated, though he would certainly not miss the Low Countries, which had long been a millstone around the Spanish neck. Anyway, there were compensations. He kept Spanish America and all the wealth that it brought him, and he was thenceforth and for the next 30 years to rule uncontested as King Philip V of Spain. Where he must stand condemned is in his treatment of the Catalans. Despite the fact that they had been staunch champions of Charles of Habsburg, in Article 13 of the Anglo-Spanish Treaty, Philip formally accorded to them, by reason of his respect for the Queen of Great Britain, a complete amnesty and all the privileges at that time enjoyed by the Castilians, of all the peoples of Spain, that which the king cherished most. It was plain from the start, however, that he had no intention of forgiving them for what he considered their disloyalty, and early in 1713 he had demanded their unconditional submission. They, not surprisingly, had refused, and had set up a provisional government of their own, whereupon, in July 1714, Philip had sent a detachment of troops to invest Barcelona. The city fought back and indeed held out for nearly 2 months, even after the besiegers had been joined by a French army under the Duke of Berwick and a French fleet. It refused to surrender. On the night of 11 September, there was a general assault. The Catalans doggedly defended every street, often every house, until they could fight no more. The survivors were sold into slavery, and the standards of Catalonia were, by the king's orders, burned in the public market by the common hangman. Whether Philip V ever felt remorse for his treatment of the Catalans is doubtful. He soon, however, had cause to regret his surrender of Spanish Italy. Soon after the death in 1714 of his wife, Maria Luisa of Savoy, he married the 22-year-old Elizabeth Farnese, niece and stepdaughter of the Duke of Parma. The new queen, undistinguished by beauty, education, or experience, began as she meant to continue. Before she even reached Madrid, she picked a quarrel with the Princesse de Ursins, who had traveled halfway across the country to meet her, on the stairs of a wayside inn, and bundled her unceremoniously, alone and shivering, over the snowy Pyrenees and back to France. On arrival in the capital, she immediately summoned her uncle's agent, a highly intelligent, if unscrupulous, churchman named Giulio Alberoni, the son of a gardener in Piacenza. From that day, all French influence vanished from the Spanish court. It became Italian through and through. And Alberoni, whom just 3 years later she persuaded Pope Clement XI to appoint a cardinal, quietly set to work on the general reconstruction of Spain, with particular reference to the creation of a fleet. Since Queen Maria Luisa had left 3 sons, Elizabeth could have little hope of the Spanish throne. Her long-term objective was, therefore, to ensure her succession after her uncle's death to Parma and Piacenza, and also perhaps to Tuscany by virtue of her descent from the Medici. Nor was she alone in desiring it. The Emperor Charles was still unhappy with the recent dispensations. He was particularly riled by the grant of Sicily to the House of Savoy, and was known to be in contact with Victor Amadeus, with a view to exchanging it for the island of Sardinia. Elizabeth and Alberoni were equally determined that he should do nothing of the kind. Sicily, once it had become part of the empire, would constitute a permanent threat to Spain's Mediterranean coast. They first moved, however, against Imperial Sardinia. In August 1717, an expedition sailed from Barcelona to Cagliari, and by the end of November, the island was theirs. Only then, emboldened by this easy success, did they decide to move directly on Sicily. On 1 July 1718, Spanish troops were landed near Palermo, where they received a warm welcome, giving strength to the Spanish argument that both islands, having been in the possession of Aragon since the 13th century, and thus for more than 100 years before that kingdom's union with Castile, were far more Spanish than much of Spain. And so at that time they were, but the argument was unlikely to appeal to Charles VI, and Charles had just concluded what was rather misleadingly described as the Quadruple Alliance with Britain and France. The empire had no navy, but Britain did. And so it was that a British fleet, under Admiral Sir George Byng, hastened to Sicily, where it totally destroyed the Spanish fleet off Cape Passero, at the island's southeast corner. Unfortunately, Britain was not, at that time, at war with Spain. She was acting only in behalf of her ally, the Emperor. Byng's action thus created a tidal wave of violence, the effects of which were felt throughout Europe, as far away as the Sweden of Charles XII and the Russia of Peter the Great. Victor Amadeus, too, was loud in his protests, but he had to submit to the inevitable. The kingdom of Sicily was taken from him and given to Charles. That of Sardinia was granted to him in its stead. Where Britain was concerned, Alberoni's rage was such that he launched a second armada, a threat which in London was taken very seriously. On 17 December 1718, Parliament declared war. Less than a month later, France followed suit. The armada, when it sailed in the summer of 1719, proved no more successful than its famous predecessor. It ran into storms in the Bay of Biscay and was wrecked off Finisterre, never even reaching English waters. A separate expedition headed for Scotland and actually landed a Spanish force in the Western Highlands, of which, however, the clans soon made short shrift. More serious for Spain, and a good deal more surprising, was the arrival of a French army under the Duke of Berwick. Philip V had difficulty in believing that his own country would take up arms against him, or that Berwick would march against his old friend, but he was soon disillusioned. There was nothing much he could do about it, since his army was away in Sicily. He had to watch powerless while Catalonia was invaded and Vigo occupied. Alberoni, the ultimate author of all these misfortunes, could no longer hold out. In December 1719, the victim of a conspiracy led by his old patron, the Duke of Parma, he was dismissed and banished from Spain. In foreign affairs, he had been an adventurer and an intriguer, impatient and overambitious. Domestically, on the other hand, he had shown himself a fine ambassador and, although primarily a patriotic Italian, he had worked hard and, on the whole, effectively for the benefit of his adopted country. After his departure, there seemed no reason to continue hostilities, and Philip hoped for favorable terms. He was disappointed. Britain, France, and the Empire refused absolutely to listen to him until Spain, too, had joined the Quadruple Alliance, which on 17 February 1720, with extreme reluctance, she did. When all those international agreements, collectively known as the Treaty of Utrecht, were signed during the first 4 months of 1713, Venice had been in possession of the Peloponnese for just over a quarter of a century. Her new experiment in empire had not been a success. The years of Turkish occupation that had preceded her reconquest had reduced a once prosperous land to a place of poverty and desolation. All too soon, she had realized that the task of administration would be expensive and largely thankless. The downtrodden local populations, their patriotism nurtured and sanctified, as always, by the Orthodox clergy, dreamed of a nationhood of their own and saw little advantage in having their infidel overlords replaced by Christian schismatics, who showed no greater sympathy with their aspirations. Defense was another problem. In former days, when the Venetian presence had been confined to a few important commercial colonies and garrison towns, it had been manageable enough. But how could nearly 1,000 miles of serrated coastline be made safe from invaders? Even such new defenses as were deemed indispensable, like the lowering fortress of Acrocorinth, still today one of the most impressive examples of Venetian military architecture in existence, served only to antagonize still further the local inhabitants, with whose taxes it was paid for and with whose conscript labor it was built. No wonder that when, in 1715, Turkish troops appeared once again on the soil of the Peloponnese, they were welcomed as liberators. Damad Ali, Grand Vizier of the Sultan Ahmet III, had planned a combined operation in which a land force would march down through Thessaly, while a fleet sailed simultaneously southwest through the Aegean. In the course of the summer, both prongs of the attack scored success after success. By the time the fleet reached its destination, it had already forced the surrender of Tinos and of Aegina. While the army captured Corinth after a 5-day siege, Nauplia followed, then Modoni and Coroni, Monemvasia, Malvasia, and the island of Cythera. Meanwhile, the Turks in Crete, encouraged by reports of their compatriots' success, had attacked and seized the last remaining Venetian outposts. By the end of 1715, with Crete and the Peloponnese both lost and all the great victories of Francesco Morosini set at naught, the Turks were once again at the gates of the Adriatic. For Venice, only a single bulwark remained, Corfu. The army that early in 1716 the Grand Vizier flung against the citadel of Corfu consisted of 30,000 infantry and some 3,000 horse. For the Venetians, estimates differ. They were certainly outnumbered, but in siege warfare, comparative strengths are less important than the sophistication of offensive and defensive techniques. And here, Venice could count on the knowledge and skill of one of the leading soldiers of the day, Marshal Matthias Johann von der Schulenburg, who had fought under Marlborough at Oudenarde and Malplaquet. Then, after the peace, had sought service with Venice. He had spent much of the winter improving the fortifications of Corfu, and though he could not prevent the Turkish army from disembarking, he was able to confront it with a defensive system far superior to anything it had previously encountered. All through the heat of the summer, the siege continued. Early in August, however, there arrived reports that gave new encouragement to the defenders and struck gloom into Turkish hearts. Venice had concluded an alliance with the empire which had entered the war. The almost legendary Prince Eugene was once again on the march. He had routed a Turkish army, appropriately enough, at Karlowitz, the very town in which, 18 years before, the Turks had signed that treaty, which they had now so shamefully broken, and shortly afterwards had won a still more crushing victory at Peterwarden, where he had killed 20,000 of the enemy and seized 200 of their guns, at the expense of fewer than 3,000 of his own men. This unexpected necessity of fighting simultaneously on two fronts probably convinced the Turkish commander that if he could not take Corfu quickly, he would be unlikely to take it at all. On the night of 18 August, he ordered a general assault, to the usual accompaniment of an ear-splitting din of drums, trumpets, rifle, and cannon fire, and hideous shrieks and war cries, psychological warfare of a primitive but by no means ineffectual kind. Schulenburg was instantly at his post, summoning every able-bodied Corfiat, women and children, the old and infirm, priest and monks alike, to the defenses. After several hours, the fighting was still desperate, and he decided to stake all on a sudden sortie. Shortly before dawn, at the head of 800 picked men, he slipped out of a small postern and fell on the Turkish flank from the rear. His success was immediate and decisive. The Turks were taken by surprise and fled, leaving their rifles and ammunition behind them. Their bewildered colleagues, along other sections of the wall, saw that the assault had failed and also retired, though in better order. The next night, as if to consolidate the Venetian triumph, a storm broke, a storm of such violence that within hours the Turkish camp was a quagmire, the trenches turned to canals, the tents torn to ribbons or, with their guy ropes snapped, lifted bodily into the air and carried off by the gale. Out in the roadstead, many of the Turkish ships, similarly driven from their moorings, crashed into each other, splintering like matchwood. When dawn broke and the full extent of the damage was revealed, few of the erstwhile besiegers wished to remain another moment on an island where the very gods seemed to be against them. Indeed, within a matter of days, the Turkish commander received orders to return at once. Corfu was saved. Schulenburg was awarded a jeweled sword, a life pension of 5,000 ducats, and the honor of a statue erected in his lifetime in the old fortress. The Turks withdrew never again to seek to enlarge their empire at the expense of Christian Europe. The effect on Venetian morale was enormous. Early the following spring, a new fleet of 27 sail set out from Zante for the Dardanelles, under the command of a brilliant young admiral, Lodovico Flangini. On 21 June 1717, it met the Turks head-on, and after a battle that lasted several days, won a splendid victory, marred only by the death of Flangini, who, mortally wounded by an arrow, insisted on being carried up to his quarterdeck to watch, through glazing eyes, the last stages of the conflict. A month later, off Cape Matapan, the Ottoman fleet was again beaten and put to flight. By then, Prince Eugene had reoccupied the all-important river fortress of Belgrade, and the Turks were retreating on all fronts. Had the war continued another season and the Venetians managed to sustain their momentum, the Peloponnese might have been theirs once more, though whether this would have been in their long-term interests is open to doubt. But the Turks decided to sue for peace, and it was now that Venice was to discover how ill-advised she had been to conclude her Austrian alliance. The empire, faced with new threats from Spain, was anxious to reach a quick settlement and paid little heed to Venetian territorial claims on the entirely spurious grounds that the victory of Corfu and the subsequent upsurge of Venice's fortunes were the direct result of Prince Eugene's victory at Peterwarden. Thus, when the parties met in May 1718 at Passarowitz, together with representatives of England and Holland as mediators, the Venetian envoy, Carlo Ruzzini, found that he could make little impression on his colleagues. For 6 hours, he pleaded, calling for the restitution to Venice of Sauda and Spinalonga, of Tinos, Cythera, and the Peloponnese, or, in default of the last, an extension of Venetian territory in Albania, as far south as Scutari and Dulcinio, a pirate stronghold that she was eager to eliminate. But his appeal coincided with the news that 18,000 Spanish troops had landed in Sardinia, and he was overruled. The treaty was signed on 22 July 1718. 2 months later to the day, in another of those terrifying Mediterranean summer storms, a bolt of lightning struck the powder magazine in the old fortress of Corfu. The explosion ignited 3 smaller ammunition stores, and the citadel was virtually destroyed. The governor's palace was reduced to rubble, killing the captain general and several of his staff. Nature, in a split second, had achieved more than the combined Turkish forces had in several months. The futility of the recent war was more than ever underlined. At Passarowitz, the frontiers of the Venetian Empire were drawn for the last time. There would be no more gains or losses, or exchanges. In the Mediterranean, apart from the historic city and the towns and islands of the lagoon, the empire embraced Istria, Dalmatia, and its dependent islands, then northern Albania, including Kotaro, Kotor, Butrinto, Parga, Prevesa, and Venista. Then the Ionian islands of Corfu, Paxos, Antipaxos, Leucas, Cephalonia, Ithaca, and Zante. Finally, to the south of the Peloponnese, the island of Cythera. That was all. The age of imperial greatness was past. Still, there were compensations. Morosini's conquests had given Venice nothing but trouble. She was better off without them. Pasarowitz, inglorious as it may have appeared, settled her differences with the Turks and proclaimed eternal friendship with Habsburg Austria, the only other power which might have posed a serious political threat. The result was peace, peace which was to last the best part of a century, until the coming of Napoleon brought the Republic itself to an end. When George I, having arrived somewhat reluctantly from Hanover, succeeded Queen Anne on the British throne in 1714, he expressed himself perfectly ready to return Gibraltar to Spain. So, somewhat more surprisingly, did Stanhope, the hero of Menorca, who now effectively held the rank of foreign secretary, and who more than once gave it as his opinion that the rock was more a liability than an advantage. When he suggested as much in Parliament, however, he was met by such a barrage of protest that he hastily withdrew.